understand that Representative Lindauer, are you interested in testifying in office? Mr. Rhodes, do you want to speak on the bill?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jim Rhodes. I'm a research and liaison for the Alaska Permanent Fund. I was asked by the director to make a number of short comments on the sponsor substitute that's presently before this committee. I refer you first to page 3, line 10.
A reference is made to AS 3713-120. And at the very beginning of that segment of the statutes, the prudent investor rule is set out as binding on the trustees. And the language in this section, notwithstanding the other provisions of this section, would, in our opinion, void the prudent investor rule as it applies to the purchase of HFC bonds. But we believe that in the light of the opinion from the Attorney General's office that was rendered in connection with the first sponsor substitute, such an effort is unconstitutional. If Section 2 were left, however, we have no objection per se to that language, except we would have a technical suggestion that the word taxable be inserted before the words bonds. In all probability, the prudent investor wouldn't allow us to buy tax-exempt offerings by HFC because, as you know, there's a sacrifice of some 30% in yield, and we're not permitted to give away income that way. However, the HFC statutes themselves make a constant distinction between taxable and tax-exempt. So it would be our suggestion to insert the word taxable to remove any need for litigation, for example, to resolve such a point.
That would be line 9, just before the 21, where it says 20.
That would be after 21 and before the word bond.
Taxable bonds. I'd like to ask for a point of clarification on that. Rather, you could explain for the application of any of what we're talking about, tax bond versus non-taxable bond.
Right.
Well, and the reason that you need to have that in.
Right. The permanent fund, as an instrumentality of the state, has no tax liabilities of any kind. And so, tax-exempt debt offered by anyone is of no use to us. And typically, yields in the tax-exempt market are 65 to 75% of the taxable going rates of corporate bonds, be they public or private. So if we don't have the word taxable here, it raises the question that the legislature somehow intended to, or was attempting to make an exception in the purchase of tax-exempt offerings by HFC. It has, of course, both kinds of offerings, at least until the provisions of the Holman bill expire. Every year does offer both kinds of debt. The only kind that we have purchased, of course, has been the taxable offerings of HFC. As I was saying, in all probability, the prudent investor rule would be our standard and allow us to turn away taxes and offers. But in order to remove any possibility of having to resolve this by litigation, it was our request that you just insert the word taxes.
Let me also make a comment here. The last sale of bonds that you did purchase with a taxable bond.
Yes, sir.
And so your intention, if this law was not passed, that you would continue to buy taxable bonds.
Yes, sir.
And not exempt, just to put in profits. And the reason you may be on that, maybe just a few words. The reason?
Well, it's the sacrifice of you.
What would you do? We'll be with you this minute, and we'll let him finish up the much we had. My last 2 points, Mr. Chairman, would be a reference to provision on page 2, line 6. I'm not a lawyer and I'm not expert in hearing ordinances. I rely upon the testimony of the director of HFC, who stated that if HFC ordinances could be assumed, there would be, quote, some, quote, response by the national bond markets, with the possible consequence that the credit rating of HFC would be downgraded. Whether or not the credit rating actually was downgraded, if the market response was unfavorable, we have concern about the several millions in HSBC paper which we presently hold and which might fall in market value.
Yes, let Mr. Representative Lindauer proceed. Yes, a question. Representative Price. Sorry about that.
Perhaps a question to Mr. Rhodes. Reference line 6, maybe so much for 40 years. Are you saying that under the present term, MEHFC loan is not assumable?
It is not. MEHFC has regulations which require the due on sale clause to be a part of the mortgage documents.
Why is that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm pretty familiar with these matters over the years, but I'm not pretending to be an expert, and you could probably get a better, more satisfactory explanation from the director of HFC. But I'm not sure that strictly the investors are being reasonable here, but that's, of course, not always required of them. The trend toward due on sale began several years ago when a number of financial institutions, notably savings and loans, found themselves in a desperate plight of earning less on their mortgages than they were having to pay to their savers. And that was the result primarily of being locked in with old mortgage rates and not requiring due on sale, that is, the note be immediately due and payable upon the resale of the home to a second buyer. Instead, someone else came in and took over the note. There were also instances where it was very loose as to the credit standards of that second purchaser. But putting that to one side, their main concern was getting trapped in a time of rising interest rates. And, of course, there were a number of large mergers required at the national level. Now, strictly, with HFC, what happens when a person, supposing you own a home and sell it to me, so that HFC is cashed out for your particular loan, what do they do with that? They have two choices. They could place it in what essentially is an escrow account, and if interest rates are favorable, say a debt that was issued as a result of lending you money to buy a house was selling it, say, 14%, and they could go into the money markets at 16, they'd want to keep the loan that was paid off in this escrow account and having it earning to the advantage of HFC. In the event, however, that the other situation obtained, that the mortgage paper was selling, 14, but you could only earn 11 or 12 in the money markets, you'd want to exercise your option to call that debt that was issued to provide the money for you to buy the house. And so, presumably, HFC wouldn't want to lose that freedom as they might under this language. But I didn't hear all of the director's testimony, but I am quite sure from my memory that HFC requires due on sale as a condition of mortgage agreements, as does the permanent fund itself when we sell individual mortgages. We also require due on sale. But my concern was I was relying on someone else's judgment here. It might be the case that HFC's financial situation was not altered, and that there was no potential loss of earnings from arbitrage, or on the other hand, their freedom to avoid going on paying interest by calling the debt. But if the market reaction began first, then we have HFC paper that's going to fall in value. And to that, we represent France.
I have further question about the concern.
I will point out to the committee at this time that with the discussion that I had with Representative Windauer, there was a possibility of adding another sentence at the end. We can bring it up as a benefit at a later time. Representative Ford, do you have a question?
No, it's not really a question. I've got a difference of opinion of the method of HFC doing sales bonds. The current practice now, they will opt out not to allow loans to be assumed.
The last time I had personal familiarity was at the end of last session, so I haven't read the mortgage side, but it's possible that HFC reserves to itself the right to grant an assumption in return for some rate. But I understand that that's their prerogative and not that of the borrower, whereas this has the force of law, may be assumed after 4 years.
Representative Price, the question is,
Chairman made just additional mention. It comes back to mind now that over the years, the banking institutions would improve, the mortgage institutions have looked at more flexible terms in their lending and have elected not to permit refinancing and assumptions on the premise that they do want to take a second look at that paper. There was a time when you could have, let's call it, creating substitute money out of the middle. They no longer will do that because of the underwriting responsibility that we take slain. And I would think here that by making this a matter of law, it could feasibly deal with some problems in the return makers, which was indicated. If the long term is over, if the cost of capital is high, they do deserve the right to raise that and raise it to the higher level.
Those in my comments, except if I may reiterate that the trustees passed that kind of legislation touching on the management or investment of a private fund be deferred until next year. And quickly, there were three reasons. They wanted further time to carry out the amendments to the Permanent Fund Act that were granted last year, notably a wider investment authority. Secondly, more experience with our new independence from the Treasury. And finally, the trustees are very anxious to continue the practice that began in 81 of meeting with a special liaison committee of the legislature to assess the various proposals that have or will be made for altering the way the fund is managed and invested. And Mr. Bettisworth, the chairman of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, which has oversight for the permanent fund, has expressed an intention to seek such a committee again. Its core membership would come as before from LBNA, but also members would be drawn from the House and Senate generally, chosen by the presiding officer. And it's our concern that we not do these changes in pieces, but do them at one time. I think we're a little concerned with this because we don't quite see the urgency of it. One last comment.
Yes.
The effect of Section 2 is that we could buy AHS. time do you find the word shall? Because it would be imprudent, in the case of permanent but unconstitutional, to bind trustees to pursue any kind of investment on an indefinite basis. You'll know from your own experience that at times buying treasury bills would be a mistake on the part of someone with a fiduciary obligation because the rates were equal to or running less than inflation. And you would prefer anyone running a trust for you or your family to seek something of comparable risk or better yields if they were available. So we don't even have the word shall ahead of treasury bills and other U.S. securities. It's to permit the trustees the greatest amount of flexibility as to the kinds of investments and the mix of those investments, portions, and the maturities, how long or short they are.
Say one additional thing is that the reason the shall consider does not mean shall use or anything else. Shall consider, that means they will think about it. It doesn't require them to do anything. What other language they have in the bill is irrelevant. This language in no way does anything except direct them to consider past rental history, past borrower rental payment history. This requires them to take no action. It doesn't require them to buy any bonds or do anything else. So anxious about this raises questions about their whole organization.
Okay, so your suggestion is that shall consider it comes into the end. semicolon, with the approval of the corporation in accordance with regulations adopted by the corporation.
My comment on that, Mr. Chairman, is if members of the commission know that Chairman Wright did discuss this with the Assistant Attorney General, and it was her opinion that this might be fully indicated as a use of cooperation for the separate problems.
Okay.
reading your memo, purpose of this bill is to increase the availability of monies to finance Alaska home loans. You essentially have made the determination there's not enough funds to finance Alaska home loans, but
not necessarily. The answer to that is much more complicated than yes or no. Today, we may not have a problem. We have an ever-changing world, ever-changing bond ratings, ever-changing potential buyers of bonds, ever-changing interest rates. Just because we are taken care of today doesn't mean that we are taken care of tomorrow. This just provides an alternate mechanism. If the permanent fund trust teams can get together with the AHMC directors, they would be allowed. It authorizes them to get together. If they can't work something out that they won't live with, obviously they have no deal. This authorizes them to make a deal. It also sets up and segregates a type of issue that no way would pollute any other issue. If this should ever happen, it allows them to set up a new program, not try to graft whatever condition might arrive in the future. This gives them a new program that they can activate if they can ever get together on it. I hope there's never a crisis. I hope they never have to worry about these things. I hope they never have to sit down. But in the real world, things always change.
I gather. Well, in the real world today, there is no need and probably not for a single future, unless we just prolong the program we've already set up. Secondly, you state that it privatizes the loan process by providing for bank determination of eligibility of borrowers. Isn't that also the case for the last thousand programs?
To some extent, yes. We have.
The primary purpose of this legislation then is to tie the housing market in Alaska to the permanent fund.
Authorize them to get together. It doesn't escape me that until this legislation was being actively discussed only a week or so ago, that for the very first time the permanent fund ever bought any HFC bonds. And whether there's a relationship after all this time, but the fact this legislation is coming out is a matter of sheer conjecture. Was legislation drafted and was first heard in this committee, they have never done so, despite the fact that we had some of the best bonds, highest rated, most secure paper that we have.
I don't know if that's
original version of 156. In concept, our office supported, however, it had mechanical problems as far as implementation is concerned. We introduced a bill that had mechanics, or that does have mechanics for the implementation of the reserve program. And subsequently, in discussions with Representative Schultz, he decided that he'd like to adopt our bill substitute for his original 156. I played a very key role in drafting this bill, and I think that I am qualified, rather, to answer any questions you may have on it. Before doing so, however, I'd like to make a couple of statements. That one, the reason for development of agriculture in the state of Alaska is to develop an economic foundation for the interior of Alaska as well as the state as a whole. Our economy is currently one of a nature that is outgoing. In other words, we're bringing up products that we consume. The economic funds are leaving the state. Two, that the current world price for all feed grains is depressed. And it's quite unfortunate at this stage in that we are just now developing our agriculture, and all of a sudden the incentive to our grain producers is gone. The question there is that do we go ahead and let the grain producers fall by the wayside and let the fields overgrow with brush, or do we support them at this time and continue on with the development? Enlarge our operation until there is a reserve program in the state, because we will not go outside to purchase livestock without having an adequate supply of feed to get into the winter. With that, I'd like to make myself available to any questions pertaining to the reserve program.
What is the maximum amount of loan that can be secured on this program?
There is no maximum, basically, because you'll be restricting the producer's output. But at the same time, we would not have any problems with the placing of limits. So, whatever the kind of is.
How much money is available in the loan program? Is this a new program, or is this one that's already in existence?
There's a special appropriation bill that should contain companion this bill, which will put $4 million into the reserve and into the revolving loan program, which this bill does establish.
Representative Price, I believe we do have that today. This appropriation bill is $4 million. Would be great.
Yes, yes. I was wondering about the value of disbursement, but it says here in the council, you know, let's make the loan based upon the doing on the target. Some of the grain and storage. In other words, put a 50,000 bushel of barley, and the target price of barley was 2 ounces per bushel. The council could loan him about
25% of his volume, yes.
Or $99,000. Now, this money is loaned after the grain has been harvested and put in storage.
Yes, sir.
I know that was one of the better things I asked for the captain present. It doesn't say that in here. That should be a balance. I read the bill.
I'm sorry, I'm missing the point there.
The point is that we take it, they said it has the qualifications I sent that's the number three grade of gravel, or grain. So it doesn't say it has to be in bid.
Which bill are you looking at, sir? 156 or the committee or the substitute that is being proposed?
It's the draft that we've got before you at this time. There's a number on that Senate bill we have, of course, that the draft that I created.
It's 169.
Senate bill 169 is committee substitute.
By the way, is this modeled after the same legislation that was enacted after the 1930
similar, sir, but the reason for it not being exactly the same is that we are developing industry, and the industry outside is a well-established industry. And they're using the program right now to reduce grain production in the over 3 acre contiguous states because of an oversight of grain.
And in the analysis, that's basically this program is aimed at keeping production low. In the analysis that I've read,
Well, let's see, the maximum that they've grown up in Delta, I think, is about 10,000 tons in 1 year. Last year, they grew up about 7 tons, something like that. And we didn't anticipate the same thing to happen this year. The primary reason for that is because the farmers have nowhere to go for a market. And this grain reserve program would give them a prop, would allow the state to share the risk of growing that grain so that we can get the red meat industry going. The idea is that after the red meat industry is going, they should be able to absorb upwards of 100,000 tons of grain in the state. We have an incentive for the producer to grow grain. Now enter into the picture red meat producers. There is a reserve on hand with which the red meat producer can buy grain. Okay. As far as timing is concerned with hog production operations, you're looking at 1 year construction cost, 1 year breeding cycle. So we're looking at 2 years before we're going to produce hogs after the point at which we have a reserve. For cattle, we're looking at 3 year breeding cycles, and we're going to look at a year to get the cattle up here. So I'd say within 2 and 3 years respectively for hogs and cattle, we will we'll see livestock production.
What's the dollar value of 10,000 with bushels?
Oh, with the old tons, I think
it's been 10,000 tons. That's what we've grown with, so is that worth $2?
The local market.
What did it sell for?
$11. $100. $100,000.
We're getting $4 million to raise $200,000 for the summer.
Well, basically, we're looking at more than 10 because we want to entice upwards of 100,000 tons.
So 100,000 would be 1 million.
But looking at it realistically, sir, we're not going to see production.
Could we not make $4 million and buy some of the U.S. government from outside this?
It's a short-term band-aid effect to the problem of where we're going to get our grain. But in the meantime, we've got to establish producers so that at the time that that grain would then be consumed, we would have producers there to continue growing.
Could I interject? We did some analysis during the first meeting of the Ag Task Force, which is the governor set up a couple of weeks ago. If you wanted to take $1 million and just appropriate it, subsidize the transportation costs of getting grain from where it's grown in the interior down to where it's fed to the cattle in the Anchorage and Kenai area, you could take $1 million and stretch it out over 3.5 years. But the problem is, in this legislature, legislators don't tend to want to do direct subsidies. They would rather appropriate money to a revolving loan fund where they're going to get money back in. So again, if you appropriate $4 million to this revolving loan fund over the period of the 3 years that it'll be in existence, you're going to be making it, what is 8% a year on your loan?
It's leverage that we're getting to farmers and borrowing them. Exactly. The purpose is just designed to where somebody grows a bunch of grain, it's put it into this bin thing, and they don't sell it, it stays there. And they get money for that. It's like, they say,
large non-conforming fish dwellings are non-conforming agricultural kinds of farming. Is it the problem that they will not take the grain as collateral? Is that it? Or they simply won't make a loan on an agricultural project?
Well, sir, I'll be quite frank with you, because of the fact that I was under the impression that the purpose of their establishment was to give loans to individual producers and not necessarily undertake, reserve programs.
It's co-ops. They are co-ops. They belong to co-ops. I'm missing something there. This is geared towards individual producers. The bill?
Yes, it is.
How does a co-op come in?
Like it does not.
Well, I thought you just mentioned that it represents what?
I did.
Mr. Chairman, may I make a recommendation? This is an unusual piece of legislation. I asked you that we probably request the presence of the CFAP manager. We have that here.
Yeah,
very good. And, let's just see.
Always something like that.
Because, again, it's my understanding that that was one of the things that they should be doing, but they've only made the fishing boats, I think.
I think you're right, Representative Warren, that they tend to. CFAP tends to deal with those fisheries.
But then
it's also agriculture. I think you find a small minority of that one is good at agriculture. Yes, I answered. The problem is who are we going to loan this to? This $4 million to. Second of all, what kind of collateral are we going to use? That's not the basic concept of the program which we're trying to establish here. If it was viable, I'm sure the farmers would have planned it together. I mean, there is a co-op in existence at this time, and if they had the equity in which to invest to establish this program, then they probably would have to.
Rick, I'm going to interject here for a minute. As I understand it, with the $4 million fiscal note that we do have on the bill, and to your knowledge, is there anything that indicates that because we're talking about establishing a new Alaska Grain Reserve Program, which is going to be a revolving loan fund, that to make sure that revolving loan fund is going to replenish itself, the legislature in the next 5 to 10 years is going to have to continue to have $4 million appropriations? Maybe you can clarify that for me.
Yes, I'd be glad to. First of all, this bill sunsets in 3 years for review by the legislature. But the incentive in this bill to keep that from happening, to just keep the producer from sitting on the grain, is that the individual producer has to pay his storage costs. And with each year that he has to pay storage costs, the value of that grain gets lesser and lesser. Thus, he has an incentive to move that grain as soon as possible.
Representative Curtis.
One question. What is the storage life of grain?
Indefinitely, under proper conditions. Although, I would not think that grain held over 10 years would be good.
Okay. All right, let me make sure I understand the bill. The bill is to set up the Grain Reserve Program. The program, the intent of the program is to make loans to individual producers. Once the grain is harvested, it's in a storage facility either controlled by the state or approved on the farmer's farm itself.
It would be USDA inspected and approved.
Okay. And then it would be graded.
Yes, sir.
Then the state of Alaska could loan monies against that grain, using the grain as collateral. All right, but is there any objection to perhaps this, if not being done totally by CFAP, at least their program within their program? I guess what we're looking at is setting up something entirely new, as I perceive it. CFAP is already set up to do this. It appears that if they don't do it directly, at least they should manage the thing. Is that an objection to that?
I would see no objection to it, and I think the program which you are speaking of would be a marketing board program, where there would be a board of producers, and possibly in this case state officials, to basically buy the grain from the producers and then turn around and try to sell it.
Okay, well that brings up another question, then, because it appears we're assuming something. We're assuming, first of all, that there is a market out there. We're assuming, too, you mentioned a minute ago that the government has a I guess it's called a grain support program, whereby they do pay farmers to not to produce, or at least buy some of the grain out,
not
subsidize it or whatever. This is very complicated.
I realize that. We're just taking testimony today.
Yeah.
It all boils down to land ownership and federal government owning land.
I think we've got to study this a lot, because it's different than anything that we've had to deal with so far. And I call myself a gentleman dirt farmer, but this is a little bit more complicated than what I can handle.
If we could wrap things up, we have session, floor session at 4:30.
Could I make a request to the chair?
3 minutes, you may.
Can I request that I assume we're going to hold this for a little while?
I think we would want to hold it for a week or so here.
Could I request, Chair, that we contact those guys?
Forrest Paulson.
The CFAB guys, because I went to that presentation and they left me in the distinct impression, since I brought it up, that absolutely half of their loans sure should ought to go towards this type of project, although it hasn't in the past because of one reason or another.
Was that the meeting at the Cape Fox? Where they served caviar? And
yeah, that was fish heads. Fish heads.
I want to make that clear on the record. Go ahead.
If I may, I would like to make a statement that time is of the essence. We're getting to a point now where the producers should be, have already made their financial plans for this season. And they should at this time be in their machinery sheds preparing their equipment. They're not now because there is no market incentive and they really don't have any idea what the state's going to do as far as providing
an incentive. There's no place to sell the grain?
There currently is no place to sell.
One question from the chair, which I'd like to clarify here. Is it not correct that the producers of this grain right now, when they, in the case of the Delta Barley Project, some of these other case scenarios, that they have other loans? In other words, when they till the ground, they get a loan for that. They get a loan probably in four or five different cases, and yet it seems like we've kind of cobbled them along for a long period of time, and now we're just putting our extensive arm out to cobble another group. That would be, what's your feeling on that?
Well, my feeling there, sir, is we've coddled them along, but all of a sudden with the termination of the Seward project, Seward Grain Terminal project, pulled the coddling along away from them and left them high and dry, in my opinion.
Would it be better to would it be better just to put the $2 million back to the Seward Grain Terminal and we wouldn't have this problem?
Well, the market which the Seward Grain Terminal would have produced would have been a much, much more economically viable market than market outlet than the Valdez Grain Terminal market at this time. But at the same time, I'd imagine we'd still have needed a program. Yeah.
How come we're growing grain if nobody's here to buy it?
There is a market out there. The problem is setting up the infrastructure which to get it to that market.
Representative Furness. Mr. Chairman, may I suggest here that we hold perhaps an informal work session with Senator Moss and Representative Schultz, maybe do this as early as Monday. I would say Tuesday because Monday's a half of the day. I agree if there's a sort of a time of the essence kind of a deal, but you know, we need to get a better understanding of what this whole process is.
I think that's appropriate. I want to make sure that we do have the room here for 3 o'clock on Tuesday. Maybe
you okay?
As far as I know, yes.
Okay. I've got a conference room to use it.
No.
Resources is going to every day starting next Monday.
Okay, we'll find a room.
And also, by that time, we should have contacted the CFAB people to
ask them to be here.
We'll ask them to be here, and we'll set up a work session.
Yeah.
Any other further business before the committee at this time?
I'd just like to say that I think this is a wonderful idea. And thank you for the suggestion.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Charlie's off.
I don't know how we're going to get money out of this, guys.